En coloc. Une retransmission proposée par Canal Académie.
La technologie OGM peut-elle améliorer notre quotidien? C'est ce qu'affirment en substance les deux scientifiques Denis Gonzalves et Anthony Quinet dans leur communication que nous vous proposons d'écouter dans quelques instants. Tous les deux s'exprimaient lors d'un colloque international organisé à l'Académie des sciences en septembre 2008 sur la technologie des plantes génétiquement modifiées. Canal Académie vous propose d'écouter une sélection des interventions. Vous trouverez sur notre site une découpe en trois parties, ainsi que la réflexion du philosophe, ancien ministre de l'Éducation nationale Luc Ferry, sur le principe de précaution. La langue officielle de ce colloque est l'anglais, mais certains intervenants ont fait le choix de s'exprimer en français. Denis Gonzalves et Anthony Quinet s'expriment dans la langue de Shakespeare, mais vous trouverez au cours des retransmissions que nous vous proposons des interventions en français. Laissons sans plus tarder la place à Denis Gonzalves du Pacific Basin Agricultural Research Center aux États-Unis. Il présente le développement, l'essai et la commercialisation de la papaye transgénique à Hawaï après l'apparition d'un virus nettoyant tout sur son passage. On l'écoute.
My talk will be a little different than from yesterday and up to now because I've heard a lot about the science, I've heard a lot about the high cost of commercializing a transgenic plant and so forth. So what I'd like to do is sort of tell you a story. And a lot of people have not heard this story because it's not wheat or canola or these big things. But, you know, in crafting commercialized transgenic crops, whether it's a multi-billion dollar crop or a $40 million crop, it's the same thing. You have to follow the same process, the same challenges, and the same art. Now, biotechnology, in my definition, is the application of science. It's technology. And you measure your success not so much from the science, but how you use the science to actually transfer this to your clientele. So in this story, I'd like to give you this story because sometimes telling a story, you can begin to see the plot or maybe the pathway that one might take. And this is an orphan crop. And, you know, I'm not too worried about these big crops because the companies will take care of them. The acres of all this wheat and maize will increase because the big companies have it. But the orphan crops, in which a lot of it the public sector have to do it, that's where the challenge is. And I would surmise that that's where a lot of you probably maybe looking at or should look at. So I'll begin this papaya story. Well, you know, I'm from Hawaii, and I spent a lot of my years at Cornell, but I'm back in Hawaii, and I titled this talk, Genetic Engineering Papaya in Paradise. Well, you know, Hawaii is a very nice place to live, but also why I mentioned paradise, because I've been one of these fortunate people in my career that could practice my science without too much interfering from politics and so forth. So it was really up to me whether I could practice science and bring it to the clientele that we were after. And on the left here, you see basically this, I could talk my whole seminar over the Hawaiian story, and then I could tell you about the other story in Thailand. But in a story, really, there's a problem you have to address, the technology that you have to use that you've heard a lot about. But in life, in science, there's time and there's reality. You know, if you take too long to do something, time passes you by. We all have the same amount of time, 24 hours a day, and it depends how much, how you choose to use the time. But you all have the same amount of time, but also there's different realities. In the U.S., we have a different reality. In the Europe, you have a different reality. In the Southeast Asia, you have a different reality. And this papaya story more or less will tell you all about these different realities that we had to face. Now, why are we working with a papaya ring spot virus? Because really it's the most widespread viral disease throughout the whole world. And papaya is growing a lot throughout the world, tropical, subtropics. And this is the papaya ring spot disease. Well, how does it relate to Hawaii? Well, in 1949, this was the ground zero of the papaya ring spot. It was discovered here. It was named here. And you know, Hawaii is an island state. It's composed of eight different islands. Well, over here was where the major papaya industry was in 1949, the virus came in, rapidly spread. By the 1950s, essentially they had destroyed the industry. So what happened is classically the Hawaiian industry moved to the Big Island in Puna, in this area. There are a lot of cheap land, sunshine, rainfall, but there was no virus. So the things moved along, but as you expect, naturally the virus followed. It somehow was transmitted from Oahu to the Big Island to Hilo, and then along to the Kona coast. So by 1978, basically the virus was on the Big Island, where the now then 95% of Hawaii's industry was in this area. But there was no virus, so everybody was still happy. But you could see the virus was just lurking. So in 1978, I got involved in it. And basically why we got involved was I'm a plant pathologist, a more practical type. Well, the virus is only 19 miles away from the main papaya growing area. It was a potential problem for many years, but it was not really severely affecting the Hawaiian industry. But one of the lessons in this story is actually control measures were taken in advance of the problem. We did not wait until there was a big problem. Then the other thing is the team that was involved, was Jerry Slide, who was a very good molecular biologist. Maureen Fitch was a graduate student interested in transformation. Richard Manzard was a horticulturist. I was a virologist. But our theme really was more practical, trying to develop a control. Well, it was beautiful to hear Mark give his history of agrobacterium. Well, I was in graduate school in the 1960s. So by the time I finished, I was not a trained molecular biologist. So in the mid-1980s, you know, the pathogen-derived resistance concept came about. That time, technology was available, and basically the working definition was that if you put then a piece of the pathogen into the plant using all this molecular biology, you would get resistant to that plant. And at that time, the dogma was cold protein. So we utilized the cold protein from the papaya ring spot to put it into the transgenic papaya. Well, as I said, the dogma at that time was protein expression. And, you know, in science, you take what you get at that time. Naturally, we know the mechanism now is post-transcriptional gene silencing, RNAi, and all of this stuff. But back in almost a quarter of a century ago, it was more or less that was the prevailing hypothesis. This is Jerry Slidham. You notice in engineering the gene, we actually added 16 amino acids from the cold protein of the cucumber mosaic virus, because during those days, it was very difficult to use PCR. So we had to engineer it so it was translatable. So that was 1984 to 1987. Then I was very fortunate at Cornell. John Sanford was just across the building. He had invented the gene gun. So we were very fortunate. And this really here is the father of the gene gun. It's the old-fashioned gene gun. If you look closely, these are actually blank 22 caliber bullets. And actually, we had to shoot the particle-coated DNA into the our embryos. And then you see right over here, this was our thing to clean the barrel after every shot. We had to clean the barrel. But nevertheless, those were new technologies back in the 1988. But, you know, however crude it was at that time, actually by 1991, we had succeeded. Here on the left, you'll see the genetically engineered papaya. On the right was a non-genetically engineered papaya. They were about 6 inches tall when we inoculated them, and you notice that the one on the left grew tall and the one on the right stayed stunted. So we had something by 1991. Now, this was the difference in our group. The classical mode is you now go to the R1 generation, you see how they were expressed, you look at the gene copies and so forth. But when I looked at this and my friend said, oh, Dennis, we got it made, I said, no, this is just the beginning. We got to now go for the jugular. We got to figure if this thing really going to work. So instead of going through R1 generations, we actually micropropagated this and did field trials. Within a year after this picture, we're already in the fields in Hawaii on the island of Oahu. Well, because we really wanted to see how it worked. Well, from 1949 to 1992, as you see, this was the picture. The virus was close to Pune, but the long-awaited invasion of the virus into the Pune area occurred in May 1992 over here. So all of a sudden now, the papaya industry had the virus where 95% of the state's papaya was being produced. Well, this is how the industry looked in 1992, beautiful, growing of volcanic rocks. You have 100 inches of rain a year, but you have sunshine all the time, just ideal for papaya. The virus comes in May. In 2 years, this is how Pune looks like. The virus just ran through all of this place, devastated the industry. Now from being great, growing good, in a couple of years, they are now in big trouble. Well, as I showed you, we had developed a transgenic papaya, but it was under regulation. So the question is, how do you now do biotechnology transfer? We've done it scientifically. We published in Nature Biotechnology. We could have said, great, now we have somebody else do it. Well, see, I'm a farmer scientist. I'd rather try to do it myself. So we started moving. In a field plot, not greater than a quarter of an acre, Richard Manzart, in an original trial that was started in 1992, began to breed, essentially select the papaya. Actually, we were fortunate. We transformed Sunset, which was a commercial variety, and this is one of the most beautiful aspects of biotechnology. You can impart a property into a crop and not alter its horticultural characteristics, unlike a lot of practical breeding. Well, anyway, he had then looked at this was a genetically engineered papaya. We call it Sunup. But the farmers really want a yellow color papaya. Now, because this was stably incorporated into the genome as a single locus here, he then could make an F1 hybrid with Kapoho. At that time, was a dominant non-transgenic papaya. Yellow is dominant over red, so we got a yellow color papaya. We call it the rainbow. You know, in Hawaii, you have a lot of sunup, and you also have a lot of rain. We call it the rainbow papaya. So these were the two by 1995 that we had to move through. Well, at that time, we then said, well, let's see if this thing really works, really counts. So we actually did a field trial with all the permissions right in the middle of Pune, where the virus was decimating things. Well, this is a trial. We started in October 1995. By November 1996, we could conclude that our transgenic papaya was doing quite well. You see, these are the transgenic papaya. These are the non-transgenic papaya. All got infected by the aphids. You can see dramatic differences here. And then by 1997, you could see the same field plot. This was a complete stand of rainbow papaya. These were the non-transgenic, all decimated. And over here, actually, we did our mixed trial where we could analyze statistically. But this was done because at that time, the farmers were saying, you know, what's the solution? They didn't believe us and so forth. Well, you know, the best way to show people is just to show them. And I still remember the day when the farmers drove up this road here, and they looked over and said, oh, my gosh, look at this thing. Then all of a sudden, they said, when can we get it? Well, they couldn't get it because we had to get it, this thing deregulated. Well, who's going to deregulate it except us scientists? We're no big companies, no big money. You know, I don't know where, I'm sure it cost millions of dollars, but in my book, it didn't cost us millions of dollars because we never had the money. We just had to do it ourselves. So, using the field trial, we applied to APHIS for deregulation. By November 1996, we have it deregulated. We applied to EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. By August 1997, it's exempted. We consult with FDA on the food safety. By September 1997, we have it. Now, the big thing in licenses, I remember talking to the papaya growers and they said, Dennis, that's great. It looks great, but my gosh, Monsanto going to charge $10 million. You're never going to get it. How do you learn that? Oh, this is what I heard. I said, you know, you've never done it. The best thing is just go straight to these companies and you find out. So a scientist had no money. So there was this papaya growers association. They had a little money. I said, why don't you go hire a lawyer? I know this lawyer in Cornell, Mike Goldman. You tell him to try to get a license on the cheap. Go talk to these people. Well, they did. By April 1998, all the licenses were obtained for the 35S promoter, the NPT2 gene, the GUS gene, and all of this stuff. So in May 1998, we started distribution of the seeds. And actually, these seeds were distributed to the growers free because the growers had participated in getting the licenses. So this was a family affair, scientists working with the growers and so forth. So we got the seeds available. So what happens? Well, you know, now I want to just recap the previous chapters of this story. Under the best circumstances, it takes time. The papaya story was fast, but it took time. 1991, we got the papaya. It wasn't until 1998 that we got this thing commercialized. 7 years. Now, when it takes time, you don't want to be changing your approaches too many times in search of the ultimate solution, because you got to go back to ground zero and start all over again. Even though this is old technology, it works. So the moral is, you have a goal, you keep on moving towards that goal. Timing is absolutely critical. So what happened? Well, I still remember some farmers said, I'm going to wait. I'm not going to get these transgenic seeds and so forth. But some farmers said, give it to me, man. I want to try it. Well, this is one farmer. This is his fields. It was devastated. He cleared out his field, grew the transgenic papaya, grew all this young transgenic papaya. You can see the dramatic impact here. And so he quote, took a chance on his transgenic. Well, he was a year and a half later, he was laughing all the way to the bank because he was one of the first to take it on. He took a chance. He took a calculated risk, but he got it. Well, from 1999 to now, more or less, this is a common scene. The transgenic papaya occupies about 80% of the papaya in Hawaii. And so it was transformed from 1994, from devastation to now. So it's been a decade now that we've had this transgenic papaya commercialized in Hawaii. You know, over 300 million pounds. No one had a stomachache from this thing yet. Well, this is, you go to the markets, you'll see rainbow papaya, 89 cents a pound and so forth. So it's just part of life in Hawaii. And I remember at that time people say, oh, people are not going to accept it and so forth. You know, my philosophy is, I'm not that interested in talking philosophy if I can't get the answer. I said, you go, and it was labeled at the beginning. It likely so, you know, you got to get it to test it. So it's been tested now for 10 years. Well, now, the reality is that 25% of Hawaii's papaya is shipped to Japan. Now, Japan has not okayed the transgenic papaya yet. So we had to figure out, well, we didn't want to lose the Japan market. So the idea is, well, Japan does not accept the non-transgenic papaya, so somehow we have to coexist in Pune. We've been doing that for 10 years. I hear all this coexisting. Well, we've been doing that for 10 years. And why? Because we had to sell papaya to Japan. But the ideal case is to deregulate the papaya in Japan naturally so you could send it. So this is what we began setting out to do. So here is a case in coexistence today. On the right side, you have transgenic papaya. On the left side, you have non-transgenic papaya. Right in the middle, you have a little berm of about 20 yards, and this papaya is sent to Japan. You say, oh my gosh, the pollen's going to flow and all of this stuff. That's true. But, you know, Hawaii worked with Japan. We developed an identity preservation protocol in which we have methods to check the non-transgenic, send it to Japan, and Japan has zero tolerance. Every papaya shipment that go to Japan, they check every shipment. They have zero tolerance. And we've been shipping to Japan for 5 years with no problem using this identity. If you want to do it, you can do it. That's the bottom line. So, but identity preservation protocol gives us a stopgap measure, allowed economic shipment of papaya to Japan. But ideally to deregulate it. So I remember the papaya industry tell me, Dennis, you know, we got to get this thing deregulated in Japan. Are we counting on you? I said, yep, well, I don't know how to do it, but we got to figure out how to do it. So they said, we're going to give you $5,000. So they gave me $5,000. Okay, Dennis, go on your way and do it. I said, okay, well, let's try. Well, anyway, by 2002, you need approval from the Ministry of Agriculture, Fishery, and Forestries, Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. By 2002, things went well. Actually, Ministry of Agriculture, Fishery, and Forestries approved our papaya, but we needed from food safety aspect from Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. We applied these things. As I said, you know, not having much money, a lot of this was done as a side business. Postdocs come in my lab, graduate students say, you know, Japan wants to figure out the border sequences, so that's, you know, as part of your project, you start doing this. So we had no money to do it, but we had the will to try to do it. So we're moving forward. It's coming close. We haven't started quite hit it yet. But, you know, oddly enough, you know, in my book, wheat, canola, soybean, they don't sell it in the stores as labeled. It's for feed and so forth. But this papaya will be labeled in Japan. They'll have a choice. Transgenic papaya versus transgenic. So it's becoming, actually in the U.S., a lead case for the deregulation of specialty crops or orphan crops in other countries. Now, like Europe, a lot of people are saying, Dennis, man, you can get into Japan, but they'll never accept it. I say, well, if I get to the stage where you can really test it, then that's good. We need to test that stuff. So, but, you know, the virus is still in Hawaii, so people take a chance. It's taking a chance growing non-transgenic papaya. Here's a farmer trying to grow non-transgenic papaya too close to virus-infected papaya. As you can see, he got devastated, spent lots of money growing it, but the transgenic papaya grew nice, and he had to cut down on non-transgenic papaya. So let's recap this Hawaii story. From 1978 to 1990, we started doing work. By the mid-80s, we were doing molecular biology work to try to get by 1991. We had this. Again, you know, we had a goal. It was a very practical goal to move forward. 1991 to 1998, we got it deregulated. And now from 1998 to 2008, we're trying to get it in Japan. Well, whether we'll get it in Japan, I think so, but a lot of people have been telling me, Dennis, man, you've been trying for a couple years now. I don't know if you're going to get it. I said, well, you know, you never know, but if I get it, I'll be the first one to get it. So I think it's worthwhile doing it. I think we're pretty close, actually. But now, let's get back to the reality check. Now, in the mid-80s, I was working with the northern part of Thailand to try to help these very poor people. And we're doing cross-protection. Some virologists may know what cross-protection. We would deliberately inoculate papaya with a mild strain and try to immunize it. Well, we're trying to help these poor people. But the Thailand project gives you a reality check. I did not want to leave the Hawaiian story where you say, oh, that's a fairy tale. Well, anyway, this is the people we're trying to help. You can see they grow the papaya in the backyards. They eat green papaya salad. It's not really big commercial plantings. Well, like anything, technology got better. Well, I'll wrap up in over 5 minutes. Technology got better. And actually, a scientist came to our lab in late 1995. By mid-1997, she had developed a transgenic papaya at Cornell. Took it all the way by airplane to Thailand, and then they started working on it. And then you can see by 1999, beautiful results. Look at this here. Beautiful transgenic papaya, non-transgenic papaya. I thought, oh, my gosh, we're going to transfer this technology. We're on our way to get it going. Look, everybody's happy here, tasting. This is my wife, Carol, tasting the papaya. These are our transgenic papaya compared to the non-transgenic papaya. You know, compared to the pictures you've seen of virus infection, you see beautiful papaya, uniform quality. I thought, oh, my gosh, I got it made. This is 2004. And then these are the scientists. This scientist here, she was late 50s. She came to my lab, knew nothing about transformation. She did it. This is another scientist here. Excellent plant pathologist, did this in the confined field trials here, growing beautiful. But, you know, in Thailand, you cannot deregulate a pupa until you have on-farm field trials. Well, in 2004, the government placed a moratorium on on-farm field trials, so that was the bottleneck. They briefly lifted it briefly in 2004, but due to various political pressures or whatever, they reinstated it. So actually, the transgenic papaya remains confined because unless we can go to field trials, we cannot get it commercialized. But, and again, you know, when you get things going, some people don't like what you're doing. In 2004, Greenpeace took action in our papaya, Thailand papaya. These are them here. You can see the signs over here, stop GMO field trials and all of this stuff here. So this is part of the reality that we have to deal with in our Thailand project. But, you know, as I end the story is part about timing, it's part about reality. And when someone writes a story, they have some kind of motive. And, you know, I'm very happy I took part in the Hawaiian experience. I think we've had impact. But part of my biggest goal in my career has been to try to help the people in Thailand. I took this picture in 1986. Here's a lady. I was teaching her how to grow this cross-protected papaya. They had this was a water catchment that they used to take a bath. And I figured, you know, but this technology did not work. It really did not work. But we kept on trying. By 2004, in April 2004, I came back. At that time, we were flying high, beautiful transgenic papaya. I asked my colleagues, I said, you know this lady, you remember that lady 18 years ago that I took this picture of? Do you think she's still alive? I said, yeah, she's still alive. He said, you know, why don't we bring her to the field? Because at that time, I thought, oh, my gosh, in a couple years, we got it. So this is her, 18 years later. I was very happy to see her smiling with his nice transgenic papaya. But, you know, the reality is the papaya is still in the field. And unfortunately, my lady friend, she was 94 years old at the time, has gone to a different world. So I'll never be able to present her a transgenic papaya in her backyard. But the reality is the virus continues to damage crops. Transgenic papaya is available in Thailand. When will it become available? That's the moral of the story. And that's what I've heard. I've heard a lot of comments and so forth. But, you know, in the end, it takes the commitment. It takes the commitment of trying to do what you think is right. And that begins to transcend the cost. That begins to transcend everything. And I would dare say that the orphan crops are the stuff, thing of the future. These commodities, the big company is going to take care of them. You don't need to worry about that. But it is orphan crop that you have to worry about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vous venez de suivre l'intervention de Denis Gonzalves sur l'exemple de la culture de la papaye transgénique à Hawaï. Restons avec un autre scientifique américain, Anthony Kinney, du DuPont Experimental Station. Il travaille avec d'autres équipes à l'élaboration de plantes enrichies aux oméga-3 que l'on trouve habituellement dans le poisson. Du colza à la sardine, il n'y a qu'un pas. On l'écoute.
I'd like to thank Michel Cabosh and the organizing committee for the kind invitation to speak here. I'd also like to thank Antoine Lavoisier up there for teaching Eleuthia Irénée DuPont about chemistry and making the DuPont company possible 200 years ago. I'm going to tell you two stories, one of a trait we've been working on for many years, but it is of significance because it's about to be commercialized. And then of another trait that is really in the early stages of research, but has the potential for a large impact. Oops. I'm going to tell you, concentrate mainly on soybean and soybean oil, not only because that's what we work on, but also because it's of its importance. There's about 8 million metric tons of soybean oil produced in the U.S. every year, and about 90% of that, 95% of that is eaten by humans. Vegetable oils really consist of fatty acids esterified to glycerol, and the properties of the vegetable oil depend mainly on the fatty acids. And both the chain length and the double bonds in the fatty acids are important in determining their properties both in food and cooking and in human health, and that's what I'm going to talk about. The majority of food oils are very rich in polyunsaturated fatty acids, particularly linolenic acid, which is an omega-6 fatty acid. It's 18 carbons with two double bonds, and you can see this pink stuff is the proportion of linolenic acid in soybean oil and in other oil seeds. In soybean, it's the predominant fatty acid is linolenic acid. And there are, you can ask the question, what are the nutritional consequences of consuming of linolenic acid composition? Well, one thing about linolenic acid is it's very unstable. It's oxidatively unstable. During cooking, it breaks down into all kinds of secondary compounds, and these compounds taste and smell very bad, and they're associated with a rancid flavor of untreated oils. For that reason, oils are hydrogenated. This is a technology that was introduced about 100 years ago to increase the stability of oil and to provide replacements for animal fats. When you hydrogenate oils, you remove double bonds artificially by sticking in hydrogen, and this leads to the formation of trans fatty acids. And I think you saw in the presentation yesterday that unsaturated fatty acids are kind of bent like this. These are the natural cis unsaturated fatty acids. Trans fatty acids are stiff and straight, and they look more like saturated fatty acids. And these trans fatty acids end up in your food. These are America's favorite fries. I got this from their website. You can see a large proportion of the fat in a bag of fries are trans fatty acids. And why is that an issue? Well, a lot of people are now saying that these trans fatty acids will kill you. Depending on who you believe, this could be as few as 6,000 people a year, or it could be as many as 100,000 people a year are killed by trans fatty acids in the food. So polyunsaturated fatty acids are made in the developing oil seed by a series of desaturase reactions from oleic acid, the catalyzed by a fatty acid desaturases. This is a delta 12 desaturase and an omega 3 desaturase encoded by the genes FAD2, FAD3. And it's possible to genetically block the step in the bean and prevent polyunsaturated formation, resulting in the accumulation of oleic acid in the seed oil. So we did that, and this was an event that dates from about 2001. We used a seed-specific promoter, a trait gene, the gene from soybean, and RNAi technology to inhibit the endogenous FAD2 gene. And that resulted in the blocking of the step and the accumulation of oleic acid. And as you can see in the transgenic bean, the oleic acid has increased from around 20% to about 80%. And the polyunsaturated fatty acids, particularly the linoleic, is reduced from around 60% to around 2 to 6%. So there's a big reduction in the polyunsaturates, a large increase in the monounsaturates, and also a decrease in the saturates from about 10 or 12% to about 6 or 7%. And what this does is increase the oxidative stability of the oil, and this is the oil from the transgenic bean. And as you can see, it's got an oxidative stability similar to that of hydrogenated oil. So this is partially hydrogenated soybean oil, and this is fully hydrogenated soybean oil, and this is this clear liquid oil with the high oleic that is has a similar oxidative stability compared with untreated soybean oil. The reason this is interesting for us is this really is the first biotech soybean product that has a direct consumer benefit. It helps the food industry eliminate trans fatty acids from the diet, decreases the saturates in the diet, and it also has a lot of industrial applications in lubricants, foam products, many other sort of non-food uses, and it's a renewable, environmentally friendly option for petroleum-based products. And this, as I mentioned, is on track now for commercialization beginning next year in 2009 after a long story and many years. So, you know, the sort of moral of that story is we've gone from green plants to metal plants to green plants in about 100 years. It's from the introduction of hydrogenated oil to the commercialization of this transgenic high oleic soybean oil. Well, I'd like to move now to addressing the percentage of the oil, and this is this yellow bit that is not hydrogenated. as I mentioned, this is a misprint on the slide. It should be linoleic acid. It's very rich in this omega-6 linoleic acid. And there's been a big reduction in the omega-3 fatty acid consumption over the past 40 years. And that's really due to a change in the increased consumption of vegetable oils, this grass-to-grain transition where our food sources, both the oils and the animals that we eat, are relying on grains instead of grass for their fatty acids. And as I mentioned, these vegetable oils are rich in omega-6 oils, and this has resulted in this large decrease in omega-3 intake in the human diet. So why is that important? Well, we use these essential fatty acids, linoleic and linolenic acid, the omega-6 and omega-3, to make important bioactive compounds in the human body, and basically omega-6 fatty acids result in the production of pro-inflammatory compounds. The omega-3 fatty acids are converted to anti-inflammatory compounds, and it's kind of a yin-yang situation. You need a balance of these to in your body to both promote the immune system but also to prevent inflammation. So what are these long-chain omega-3s that are made in the body? Well, they're mainly eicosopentaenoic acid, EPA, is 20 carbons with 5 double bonds, and docosahexaenoic acid, DHA, which is 22 carbons and 4 double bonds. So, you know, it's not surprising, given that we're sort of suffering from this omega-3 deficiency, that if you supplement the diet with these omega-3s, particularly these long-chain omega-3s, then you can find all kinds of benefits, cardioprotective benefits, cognitive development, they're anti-inflammatory, obviously, and, you know, the list goes on and on. The the amount of these EPAs and DHAs that are recommended to as a dietary supplement is between half a gram and a gram a day. So you can kind of fix this omega-3 deficiency. You don't have to go out eating massive quantities of flax oil or something like that. Just less than a gram a day of long-chain fatty acids can fix the omega-3 deficiency and help bring the balance back to your life. Where do we get these EPA and DHAs from? Well, if you're like these guys, you really don't have any problem. You go out and catch a lot of fish and eat them. But there is a problem. If you look at the production from wild-caught fish over the past 10 years or so, it's really been pretty stable. We've reached a sort of sustainable level of pulling fish out of the ocean. There's been a huge increased demand for fish, especially with awareness of omega-3. And this demand is being met by aquaculture. So the gap here between what we can actually pull out of the ocean and the demand for fish is being filled by aquaculture. And this is a problem, is that most fish, to grow them in fish farms, is you need to feed them fish. And it's estimated that by 2010, almost all of the wild-caught fish will be used to feed fish in aquaculture. And that's not a very sustainable situation. It takes about 5 kilograms of wild-caught fish to raise 1 kilogram of fish in aquaculture. It's a kind of a crazy situation. So the idea is, well, maybe we can produce these long-chain fatty acids in land-based plants. So simply take these pathways and stick them into a plant and make EPA and DHA in plants. To do that, we have to understand where the, you know, these long-chain omega-3s really come from in our diet. The fish themselves generally don't make long-chain omega-3s. They rely on getting these long-chain omega-3s in their diet, and they get them from marine organisms, from these protists and algae and all kinds of things that the fish eat that's floating around in the water. A couple of examples here are Morturella alpina, which is 35% LC PUFAs, and the Saprolegnia declina, which are 30% content of EPA. So the fish eat these and then concentrate these fatty acids in their bodies, and then we go and eat the fish. So the idea then is we could take the genes from these marine microorganisms, from M. alpina or Saprolegnia declina, and stick them into soybean. And what this means is adding 5 to 7 new genes into the soybean. Remember, I told you that soybean is very rich in linoleic acid, so you need to convert as much of that as possible to omega-3. There's a delta-60 saturase to add in this delta-6 double bond, an elongation reaction, and then a delta-5 reaction. And another desaturase down the bottom here to convert any arachidonic acid over to EPA, mopping up at the bottom. These enzymes all work on both omega-6 and omega-3 substrates. So to cut a very long story short, this was a kind of state-of-the-art multi-gene transformation which we kind of evolved to that includes six delta-6 pathway genes which we expressed in soybean seeds. We tested genes from many different microorganisms to find the ones that were most effective in soy. We had to find lots of new promoters that were that would work together and work in the seed and would give you maximum gene expression and coordinated gene expression of these genes of this new pathway, and that involved not only the strength of the promoter but the timing of the promoter. The construct design was very important. Which way the genes were facing, it turned out to be pretty important. And also the use of transcriptional insulators between genes to stop, one gene interfering with another. And this, is all published. There's a couple of reviews out recently. You can read the details in there. The bottom line is when you do that and you throw it into soybeans, you can make EPA in soybeans. And so these were events that we got that were around 25% EPA. Starting now, the soybean oil now is starting to look a little bit like fish oil, except that it's much lower in saturated fats, which are these guys right here. There's a little bit of this DPA, so this is an elongation product of EPA that shows that delta-6 elongase that we put in there has a little bit of activity towards EPA. No DHA, obviously, because we haven't put the DHA genes in yet. So at this point, I'd like to introduce you to a friend of mine, Euglena. Euglena has been very good to us. It has a good EPA and DHA content, the kind of EPA to DHA ratio that we'd like to see in soybean. And it's very interesting is it makes EPA by a different pathway. So the pathway that I showed you in humans and also in all of these other marine microorganisms is a delta-6 pathway. Involves incorporation of 18,2-CoA into the membranes where it gets desaturated and then conversions to CoA for the elongation and then back into the membranes for a desaturation. The delta-8 pathway of Euglena starts with this elongation of 18,2-CoA followed by a delta-8 desaturation and a delta-5 desaturation. And we thought, soybeans are very rich in 18,2. They have a very large 18,2-CoA pool. Maybe if we use this pathway, we could take advantage of that and increase the production of EPA in the seed oil. And that was, in fact, the case. When we express the delta-8 pathway compared with the delta-6 pathway, we could get up to 40% EPA in the seed oil compared with 25%. Notice there's no DPA at this point because that elongase is very specific for 18,2-CoA. Well, that was good news. It was also good news in that there was a whole lot less intermediates. I showed these things, a whole bunch of pathway intermediates. There's far fewer intermediates when you use a delta-8 pathway. So it was a cleaner oil with more EPA. There was one intermediate that we was concerned about, and I mentioned this for a reason, and that's juniperonic acid. It's actually a component of juniper berries, but it's a result of this delta-5 activity on EDA. So before the delta-8 has a chance to desaturate this EDA, some of the delta-5 comes in and desaturates it, and you get this juniperonic acid formation. It was 2% or less, but still enough to be concerned about because you don't normally see that in fish oil. You do see it in juniper berries, but not in fish. Anyway, Euglena was interesting to us for another reason, is that it was a potential source of DHA genes. So presumably, since it made a good quantity of DHA, that it was the source of this C20 elongase and also this delta-4 desaturase. So now we're getting up to the point where we're going to need to add 8 genes to actually make DHA. Nevertheless, we went ahead to look for these genes in Euglena. And we identified a delta 5 elongase. It was about 40% identical to another elongase, which our collaborators at Abbott Nutrition had identified. And as we continued to sequence this elongase, we found something very interesting. We found it's a delta 40 saturase, and it was fused to the C-terminus of the elongase. The delta 40 saturase was almost identical to a delta 40 saturase sequence that had been published, but it was naturally joined to the elongase by this proline-rich linker region that separated the two domains. So we call this gene the Euglena DHA synthase, and I'll tell you now that we've looked in a whole bunch of euglenoids, and it's something unique to these euglenoids. All of them have a DHA synthase fused with this linker. Let me quickly tell you how a rapid way of testing these genes. So we use, to make transgenic soybeans, we use particle bombardment. We bombard these somatic, pre-somatic embryo tissue culture, and then differentiate somatic embryos, and then germinate these somatic embryos into plants and get seeds, and it takes about 8 months. These somatic embryos really are your T0 seeds, and so you can actually use these to measure the effect of your seed-specific expression. They make plenty of oil, and you can look at changes. And in just a few weeks, if you go a gene testing route, you can look at the effects of your genes. You also can have these in cultures, so you can do sort of feeding experiments and that kind of thing. So I just wanted to mention that because it's important to understand these data, which is the advantage of having a fused DHA synthase. So what we did was both the domains, the elongase domain and the desaturase domain, were active separately, and if you express them in soybean embryos and if you feed them EPA, you can look at the conversion of DHA, and as you can see, the EPA is converted by expressing these two genes separately with the best promoters we had. You get a lot of DPA forming, so there's a lot of intermediate of this reaction forming when you've expressed these two guys separately. When you express the fusion, you pretty much eliminate this intermediate, and the flux through the pathway there is much better. You get much better conversion of EPA to DHA. This represents almost 100% conversion of the EPA that we fed, these pink dots, 100% conversion of the EPA that we fed to DHA. So, you know, that they evolved that for a reason, Euglena, is that it helps them make DHA more efficiently. And it's really interesting because it's a fusion of an acyl-CoA elongase and a phospholipid desaturase. So we sort of said, well, you know, can we now use that learning and make some artificial fusions? And let's go back to the delta-A pathway. Maybe we could fuse the delta-9 elongase to the delta-8 desaturase. We can use the linker that Euglena has kindly evolved for us and make what we were calling an HGLA synthase. So we took various Euglena elongases, various Euglena desaturases. We fused them together. We tested them and we screened them, and we found combinations that gave us better flux and less of the EDA intermediate. Going back then to our junipironic acid, one of the interesting things that we saw is that when you do that, when you have an optimized HGLA synthase, is that you can eliminate junipironic acid because this delta 5 desaturase can't get at the EDA anymore. It's been captured by this fusion complex. So really, just to summarize the synthetic fusion work, it reduces the pathway intermediates, it increases flux into HGLA, and it eliminates byproducts. And a key thing here is that now we're using one gene and one promoter, where before we had to use two. We went ahead and made a triple fusion now of the delta-9, delta-8, and the delta-5 desaturase, and we're able to make arachidonic acid in transgenic embryos. And so this ARA synthase is functional. And the bottom line and the implications of that for metabolic engineering is that really you can put in pretty complex pathways now with really just a few genes. So for example, you can make arachidonic acid with one gene instead of three using the ARA synthase. You can throw in a delta 17 desaturase and make EPA with two genes instead of five. And we can really begin to be realistic about making DHA because now you only need three genes and three promoters instead of seven. that's good timing because this is my last slide. So I told you really two stories. One is these eye lake oils, which are going to be commercialized beginning in 2009, the inexpensive, sustainable, healthy alternatives to chemically hydrogenated oils. And then these LC-PUFA oils, these omega-3 oils that are clean and inexpensive and sustainable alternatives to fish oil. It's a source of any of these fatty acids, the ARA, EPA, and DHA in our diet. And I'd like to acknowledge a whole number of people that have been involved in this. Howard Damude, that leads my omega-3 team at DuPont, and our collaborators at Abbott Nutrition, including Suzette Pereira, who did cloned a number of the genes that I talked about today. Thanks very much.
Vous venez d'entendre Anthony Kinney du DuPont Experimental Station aux États-Unis. Il développait dans son intervention les cultures de soja, lin et autres colza enrichis aux oméga-3 par le biais des OGM. Denis Gonzalves et Anthony Kinney s'exprimaient dans le cadre d'un colloque international qui se déroulait le 15 et 16 septembre 2008 à l'Institut de France. Il était consacré aux biotechnologies dans le monde végétal. Restez à l'écoute de Canal Academy et téléchargez les deux autres volets de ce colloque portant sur les questions suivantes. Doit-on craindre les OGM pour notre santé? Et enfin, peuvent-ils améliorer les plantes? Merci de votre écoute et à très vite pour de nouvelles retransmissions.